Because it's not, and all of us that have had experience in parenting realize it's not the same thing to be a parent to a preschool child as it is, say, an adolescent or even in middle childhood. And so that's the concern that we want to have today. I believe that over the family life cycle, now some of you when I say this will be thinking of individual life cycles and you'll say, well, there are many more stages in the life cycle of a child than what I will be presenting. That's true. I'm looking at it from the standpoint of family interaction. From my perspective, there are basically three stages in which the children are in the home during the family life cycle. The first one of those are the preschool years, when we're laying the foundations of development, and we'll be looking at that in just a few moments. The second one is the middle childhood years, when we are looking at building certain competencies or the basic competencies for getting along in our society. And then the final stage comes during adolescence, when as parents we must be concerned about aiding our children in forming a personal identity. The major or key words would be ideology and commitment as far as our children are concerned. Before looking at those particular stages and giving a little bit of the general developmental background, I want to look at three axioms, as I am calling them, of developmental studies. And then we'll come back and look at those three stages in a few moments. The first axiom is that each stage has its own special concerns. As parents of preschool children, we're looking at working for attitudes, working on our children's attitudes. In middle childhood, it will be more facts and skills that we'll be interested in. Second, each stage builds on the previous stage. That means pretty much that if something goes wrong in one stage, there's the likelihood that if it is not corrected, that it will affect the success or likelihood of success in meeting the challenges of following stages. And then finally, individuals follow the same patterns, but they follow them at their own pace. For instance, as young parents, we can't wait for our children to walk. And of course, young parents are always comparing. If it's kind of like we were when we had Jonathan, there were several other young couples that also had their first child. And so we were checking out notes and determining if Jonathan should be walking compared to when Robin was walking and so on. And actually, Jonathan walked at his own pace. Now, he went through the same sequences, pretty much. He crawled and then cruised. I learned that one. You know what cruising is? Cruising is when they walk around on the coffee table, you know, holding on to the coffee table and the couch and all. Well, he cruised for a while, and then he started walking. And then, of course, running. And then by that time, we had hoped that he hadn't learned to walk, and so on. But they go through the same patterns, the same sequences, but pretty much at their own pace. One child may walk at 10 months. It may be 12 or 14 months for another child. In this lecture, I'd like to look briefly at three things. As I said, I'd like to look at the general developmental studies over the preschool, the middle childhood, and the adolescent years. Then I would like to look at how that intersects with the biblical basis that we were looking at earlier today. And finally, then I would like to apply these principles to some of those sub-goals of obedience. How does obedience to God change over the cycles that we're talking about? Possibly reverence and service as we have time to look at those as well. First of all, let's look at some of the developmental aspects of each one of these, and I will go through these rather rapidly this afternoon. During the preschool years, as I said, we are laying the foundations for mental, social, physical, and spiritual development. Mentally or physically, first of all, let's look at that. The child is in a period of rapid growth. I wish that I could find a source other than just old lectures for this, But one of my professors at Southern Seminary gave this statistic. If a child grew at the same rate that they grow in the first 6 months of life, if they did that to 6 years, then the world would hold only 6 children at the end of that time. Now, that sounds phenomenal to me. That's why I wish I could find a better source for that. But it gives you the idea. For instance, in the first 5 months, on an average, the child will double her weight. By the time the child's 2.5 years old, she will be half of her adult size. And by the time she's 5 years old, her brain is 90% of the adult size. So there's very rapid physical growth. Not only is the growth physical, she's learning mobility and coordination during this time as well. And that starts out with a great deal of practice with the muscles and learning there. Mentally, the child is going from instinctual patterns such as sucking or grasping, those instinct reflexes that they're born with, to learning to manipulate physical objects with their hands, learning enough physical coordination to do that. And finally, then, they begin to intuitionally solve problems. We'll talk about that in just in a few moments. And the same thing is true with exploration. This is a time of exploration, as you well know, those that have young children. They're into everything, it seems like, all of the time. That goes from physical, again, to mental exploration during this time. The imagination runs free. Jacob, our youngest son, had a friend named Boomer. He still talks about Boomer every once in a while. Jake's in first grade, so he's not talking about Boomer as much. Jacob did not like for us to say Boomer was imaginary. It's all right to say that Boomer... Wait a minute now, I'm going to get this backwards. It's imaginary. What's the other word? Invisible, that's it. Boomer was invisible, but not imaginary. You could get Jacob fighting mad if you got that mixed up in it. But children do have an imagination at this time, and it runs free, and they're learning to control. Now, by the time they get in middle childhood, they're going to be asking, is that real? Is that true? But that's not the case during these earlier preschool years. Socially, we're talking about primarily the world of the home. Now, more and more mothers of preschoolers are working. It's over 50%, I believe, are the latest figures. But many of those children are still apparently in the care of relatives or individuals, with possibly as few as 15 to 20% being in daycare in the first 3 years of life. Now, that changes by the time they enter into pre-kindergarten programs at ages 3 or 4 or 5. But it's primarily a world of the home. Parents pretty well know the friends that their children have, where their children are, and still largely there are many that the children are home most of the time. Children are egocentric socially during this time. The world is seen only through their eyes for them. Spiritually, there's been a lot of work done in the area of faith development. James Fowler has written a book entitled Stages of Faith. Fowler has done some good work, and he labels this as an intuitive projective stage. Intuitive because children are not logical in their explanations of things. You can take a child in preschool, they may solve a problem, but they can't tell you how they solved the problem. They can't reverse the solution as well. And so they're solving it intuitively. As far as spiritual development goes, they're learning from Bible stories, but again, it's not a logical learning. They're not interpreting them logically as we would. It's something that they're kind of picking up through intuition. It's been entitled projective. This is because there is that tendency for young children, very young children, to project onto God their conception of God, their perception of their parents. And so it is, Fowler then terms it projective. Primarily, they learn from stories and parental actions. And again, I believe that we're basically interested in attitude formation during the preschool years. Well, several boosters fire in the child's life, which puts them into another stage. In fact, the first stage in which they are, as one writer said, they're leaving the home, they're putting one foot outside the home and keeping one foot inside the home at this time. In middle childhood, children, the boosters as I see them that are being fired, they enter school where they have friends that are no longer friends of their parents, maybe unknown to their parents. They have outside influences such as teachers and other heroes that now will give somewhat of some competition possibly to parents as well. And also mentally, there are some differences in what children are capable of doing and how they will be thinking. Physically, growth is more gradual now. Body proportions become more adult-like. They look like little men, little women. Mentally, the child is in an area now in which they can reason through solutions to problems if those problems involve concrete things they can put their hands on or that they can see. So it's a term, and it's what Piaget termed concrete reasoning, a period of concrete reasoning. There are several things that go with that, which we could discuss, but I'm going to concentrate on one of those, decentration. You take a young child in the preschool years, you hold up a skinny stick beside him, make sure the stick's taller, hold up a skinny stick beside him, and you ask which one is bigger. Most of the time, when this has been done experimentally, children of the preschool years will say the stick is bigger. Bigger is centered on one idea for them, and that apparently means taller. They interpret bigger as taller. Now, by the time a child is, say, 6 or 7 years old, then bigger won't just mean taller. They'll also know that it means more weight. It may mean wider. It may mean more volume. And so when you do that same experiment, they'll say that they are bigger, even though the stick may be taller. They realize that they weigh more. It's interesting that as the children grow during the middle childhood years, about ages 6 through 11 approximately, that they become more and more decentered. They can take more and more of those aspects of one problem at a time. And that's important for us, as we'll see in just a few moments. I'll come back to that. Socially, the child now is in the world of the school. As I said, they're adult heroes that are not their parents anymore. Morality and moral development, there is the idea of mutuality. What is fair, what benefits the most people is generally what's right. Rules and fairness are the major concepts. Spiritually, children of this age are in a mythic literal stage. Mythic because they learn through stories of faith. I don't want to imply that means the stories of the Bible are myths. Okay, let me clear that up very quickly. That's not my intention. That's just the term. They learn through stories. And then literal because they take it literally. If you talk about the beast in Revelation 13th chapter coming up out of the sea, a child of this age is going to think of a literal beast coming up out of a literal sea, I think, for the most part. They won't understand the symbolism that is behind it. And then again, basically we're concerned about, I would say, rules, facts, and skills during these years, during spiritual development. Howard Grimes, a Christian educator, has said that by the time a child reaches junior high school, in other words, gets out of middle childhood, they should know the basic story and basic facts of the Bible and should be ready to go on to integrating those stories and facts, as we'll see in just a moment. Again, booster rockets fire, which thrusts the child into a new stage of development during adolescence. Once again, the child begins to grow rapidly, or the young man, young woman begins to grow rapidly. There's physical sexual maturation during this time. It's a tough time if you're either an early or a late bloomer. as several have noted. Mentally, the child, by the time they are at least in middle adolescence, are able to reason fairly well in terms of abstract reasoning, logical, formal, mathematical reasoning. They can visualize an ideal world, and it becomes rather tough because in visualizing an ideal world, they see that parents and others are not nearly as ideal as they could be. It's a time for forming an ideology. Socially, teenagers are in a world of peers, and that was true in middle childhood as well. But there's a difference now. In middle childhood, and you may think back on your elementary school years, generally, most of the kids in a class are accepted. There may be a few that are on the fringes and on the outside, but generally, most of the kids in the class are accepted. By the time you get into adolescence, the world of peers begins to break up into groups that are rather exclusive. And there's the fear, even apparently with teenagers that are fairly well accepted, that they will not be accepted as well as they would like to be. They're critical of authority at times because of the flaws that they see. But ironically, they are still rather conventional. In fact, in spiritual terms, spiritual development, Fowler labeled this synthetic conventional. Synthetic because now they're integrating all the stories and facts and other things that they gathered during the middle childhood years. Conventional because they still tend to accept the belief system either of their families or at least of their peers. In other words, there's not a lot of independent thinking in the case of most adolescents, which that when I first saw that, I thought, no, that's not true. They're not conventional. But I believe that after reflection, that basically is true. It may come out in different ways, but it's still very much in the world of that they grew up in. Now, what does that have to do with the biblical guidelines that we gave this morning? I'll very quickly show those on the screen. This morning, we looked at the 11 o'clock session, we said that the goal of Christian education in the home is to love God, to teach our children to love God, to nurture our children into loving God. That had three elements: obedience to God, reverence or fear of God, service to God, and love for others. Actually, it had four elements. I think I said three. It has four elements there. The interaction, as I see it, falls something along these guidelines. First of all, the biblical guidelines are cross-cultural. They're timeless. They're authoritative. They don't lose their meaning. Now, they may take on different applications in different societies, but the guidelines remain basically the same. On the other hand, the material that we have from the social sciences is primarily good for application to our particular society. They're not necessarily cross-cultural, even though some of the things that I've said tend to cross cultural lines, but not necessarily cross-cultural. They're not timeless. And I believe our major concern in using them is if they are compatible with the biblical. Now, I've given you those points. Let me give it to you in a diagram that may make it a little more plain. I don't know how many of you had Venn diagrams when you were back in school. Does anybody remember that good old math term? I'm getting a few heads that are shaking. This is a Venn diagram. My understanding is that it was named after a Professor Venn. We have him to thank for this type of thing. It's a way of looking at sets and how they interact or intersect, to use a mathematical term. The green circle I've got here represent the biblical guidelines. As we noted, they're timeless, they're cross-cultural, they're authoritative, and so on. The red circle and then dotted portion of it are the social science findings, child development findings, so on. They're not timeless. They're not necessarily cross-cultural, although you may find some things in there that would fit that description. They're primarily our means of application to society. We're interested in the ones that are compatible with the biblical material. To kind of give the idea of what we talked about at the 8:30 session this morning, you can see that I'm beginning to take very much a Christ above culture stance on this, if that makes any sense to you, from what we talked about. In other words, we take from the social sciences what fits with the Bible, and we use those things. It gives flesh, as I would say, to the bones or the principles. It's a way of helping us to apply what we learn from the Bible into the time that we live today. And so with that in mind, that's where we're going. Not everything works in the social sciences. And if we're always looking to try to say the Bible is going to be judged on the basis of the latest data from the social sciences, we're going to be in trouble. I had a professor at the University of Louisville. I started to say the U of L. That wouldn't mean much to you. But the University of Louisville, he was an elderly Jewish man. And he said, basically, you have to realize that in the field of social science, which was his field, he said, you have to realize that you can find a study that will almost support any viewpoint that you want, because you can set up studies that will support those. And we need to realize that and be secure in our biblical guidelines, because that's where the truth is. That's where we can judge what's going on down here, hopefully. Well, so much for that. Let's go on to now trying to do that to some degree with these developmental theories that I'm looking at. We said that nurturing love for God in the home entails teaching our children to obey God, teaching them to have reverence or fear for God, teaching them to serve God, and finally nurturing them to love others, love their fellow man. Let's look at a few of those from the standpoint of how that changes developmentally through the years. We said that the preschool years are the years of foundations. I think attitude is probably the key word here, attitude education. Lucy Barber has a book entitled The Religious Education of Preschool Children. I don't agree, obviously, with everything that she would have in that book, but she hits some very good points, and one of them is this, that we're dealing with attitudes. So we want to teach an attitude of obedience. The child first learns to obey God through learning to obey their parents. And so that means that during those preschool years, we will be working with the control of conduct. If you remember those four types of teaching, let me repeat those briefly. There was the parental lifestyle, verbal teaching in the home, control of conduct, and then finally, family rituals. And we talked about those earlier. Okay, in the preschool years, I believe that we'll be dealing primarily through control of conduct and teaching our children to obey God, which is basically teaching them first to obey us as parents. This kind of gives you a view of this. It'd be good if I had this shaded. Over here's power assertion. We assert our power, maybe through physical punishment, maybe taking the child away from a dangerous situation, whatever it is. Over here is more verbal teaching, inductive teaching, why we are asking you to do this or live this way or whatever. Back in the preschool years, there's a lot of power assertion. I don't think that it's going to do a lot of good when a child is fixing to step out into a busy street because they don't know better otherwise, to holler out at them and say, let's reason about this just for a moment. Any parent in their right mind's going to get out there and get them away from that street. They may even give them a good swat to help them remember not to get into the street. That's why we're talking about power assertion. Now, I left a little open up here because there is room for talking to our children. We're teaching them an attitude that way. In middle childhood, you should have more of a balance. And then hopefully by the adolescent years, there will be more verbal interaction rather than actual power assertion if things have gone well during those years. Well, I'm saying over here in the preschool years and teaching our children to obey God, we're going to be using control of conduct, and primarily one way will be in power assertion. We'll be using some verbal teaching and other things as well. Verbal teaching, as I said, would not be as major an emphasis at this time in the preschool years. But we could use Bible stories in which obedience is emphasized. Read the story of Noah in the Bible. Notice there is a phrase that recurs several times. And Noah did all that God commanded him. That's the major point of that story. Get a good Bible story book that has good pictures. And you don't have to get many of these because, as all of us had young children know, they not only don't mind repetition, they thrive on repetition. I remember the first little book that we got, Jonathan, our oldest child, was entitled A Very Special Baby. We got that probably in November or October. By Christmas, he had the book memorized, and we could turn the pages, and he could read what was on those pages for us. At about, I believe he was less than 2 years or just at 2 years old at that point. So get a few good Bible story books. Don't be afraid to repeat, and don't worry about a long discussion about what this means and all at this age. Then we would, in working with our child, we must be concerned about our parental lifestyle as well. We teach our children to obey God when they observe us obeying God. They learn an attitude of obedience or disobedience, I think, primarily from us during this time. So those are some of the major concerns of the preschool years. In the middle childhood years, we're dealing with, again, competencies, facts and skills, as I would see it. Remember, we talked about decentration. By the time a child is in middle childhood, they can decenter. They can look at more than one aspect of a problem at a time. And so now they need to learn to obey not just any authority, but proper authorities for their own good. They're outside of the home now. Their own health and safety requires that. And fortunately, that coincides traditionally with the time that they are mentally able to do that. And so they need to learn God is a proper authority because He loves us. As we talked about the Hebrew parent, when the child asked, "Why do you keep these commandments?" And they started out, Moses would say in Deuteronomy 6, 20 through 25, "We were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord our God brought us out of Egypt. We do these things for our survival." God is a proper person to obey. And then they're learning God's rules. I believe in this time is the time to learn the Ten Commandments, other memory work that would center on this theme. More variety in stories. As we intimated earlier, this year at Salem, we are reading the narrative portions of the Bible through. It's a good time as you're reading those stories and they're becoming acquainted with these heroes of faith from the Old Testament to talk about those people's lives, where they intersect the concepts of obedience and service, reverence, and love for others. And then again, there will be control of conduct, as we noted, that balance between the verbal and the power assertion. And finally, again, they observe us as parents and other authority figures. I think that's one of the great things of Christian education. Children see their teachers obeying God as well. Consistency is imperative for the child now because they're able to see our mistakes more. Back in the preschool years, mother and father are pretty well perfect as far as the child is concerned. In middle childhood, they begin to see the chinks in our armor. And not only do they see the chinks in our armor, they become pretty good, I believe, at working on the things that they know irritate us during these years as well. It's kind of some free advice that I've noticed during that time. Then in the adolescent years, we're concerned with identity. It's not just learning facts and stories anymore. Now, the way indicates, out of this phrase, the way of life, the way indicates an ideology. It's a way of looking and putting things together, kind of our worldview, so to speak. And that needs to be, the way is God's way. And then second, of life, obeying God leads us to life. That's a major concern. If you'll read the book of Deuteronomy, the Proverbs, a theme that comes up over and over again is God's way leads to life. It's necessary for our own survival. And that's what we need to be concerned. I think another way of saying this might be that during the adolescent years, ideally, we will teach our children or our young people that no matter what the problem is in life, the Bible has something to say about that that will help us make those decisions. That's what I mean by teaching obedience as being a way of life, not just a set of rules now. It's a way of living. That involves verbal teaching. Now, besides stories, we can look at the letters. A good way, I think, of looking at this is the book of Ephesians. Paul goes through all of the things that we have in Christ in the first two or three chapters, and then by the time he gets to chapter 4, he says, "Now, therefore, walk worthy of the calling with which you have been called." And then he goes into what it means to walk worthily. It intersects our church life in the fourth chapter, our family life, husband-wife relationship in the fifth chapter, and the parent-child and worker relationship in the sixth chapter, and so on there. We can explore how the Bible guides us to solve issues in daily life, such as abortion, drugs, television viewing that we looked at, dating behaviors, and other things. And as I said, they must come to the conviction that the Bible is our guide, God's way of life there. Control of conduct. I believe one of the things that we overlook as far as young people are concerned is that when young people have a firmly entrenched set of beliefs or an ideology, there is research that indicates that teenagers that have those qualities have a very strong resistance, or they exercise restraint in areas of drug use and sexual relationships, other things. Don't overlook the power that this would have in the life of a teenager. And so we need to look at it from that. Some, as James Dobson has said in his book, Parenting Isn't for Cowards, for some children during the teenage years, we want to just get them through it, is the phrase that he used there. Parental lifestyle. Again, consistency is very much a must at this point. We must not only teach by our words, we must teach by our lives, because they will pick up the inconsistencies and will use that against us. We have to be able, I believe, to share more of our own faith experiences and struggles as well. It means we have the need then for good communication skills in working through teaching our children to obey God. Let's look at one or two other areas, and then we will begin to close out this final session together. Let's look at the area of service. Reverence, I think, follows very close at hand, as I perceive it, with obedience. So we'll skip reverence and go to service for the sake of time today. During the preschool years, we want our children to learn an attitude of service to God. I believe that this is one of those times when children naturally want to help mommy and daddy. We've got an opportunity which we need to take advantage of at that point. William James has a statement in education. He said, "You need to strike while the iron is hot." I believe James is pulling that from the illustration of a blacksmith. You pull out a piece of iron that is red hot. You can beat it. You can shape it. You can mold it. But if you pull it out and let it cool off, when it's cool, you cannot beat it and shape it and mold it. What James is saying is there are certain times in which children are ready for certain lessons, and we need to be sure that we hit those lessons at that time. And I think service comes fairly naturally to some degree during these years, learning that attitude of service. We can use verbal stories in which there were children, for instance, Samuel being called by God at night. "Speak, Lord, for your servant heareth," is a good lesson for our children of the preschool years to hear, just that story. Or Isaiah, the 6th chapter, you know, the little song, "Isaiah heard the word of the Lord, and he said, here am I, send me," that kind of thing that goes along. In the middle childhood years, we'll be learning the basic skills for service. Eric Erickson said that during these years, the child would think in this terms: I am what I can learn to make work. He said it's important that a child learns something well, some skill well. Robert Havighurst, who has done a great deal of work or did a great deal of work in developmental tasks over the child development, the years, said that during the middle childhood years that children literally learn thousands of facts which make them competent to live in society. That's what we want to do with service to God, is children learn how to do things, then teach them to serve in those lessons that they learn. Make those actions of service meaningful so that they can apply them to God's glory. And again, our lifestyle. As parents, we can be about helping other people. For instance, we have an elderly lady that at church I preach in, a fairly rural, it's kind of a semi-rural place. We have an elderly lady that lives by herself. She has several cows, and she has had a real hard time this year getting hay out. And Jonathan and myself have gone over. One of my concerns for doing that is to help her, but it's also to teach Jonathan and myself about serving other people. And he's able to do that. Then, during the adolescent years, teaching identity with service for God means that we learn to, in this idea of commitment, to present our bodies as living sacrifices. We need to identify the special gifts. In middle childhood, it's very varied. You're learning a little bit of everything, the 3 R's and everything else. In the adolescent years, especially toward the end of those adolescent years, it's becoming more specialized. And I think this is where Paul's teaching on the body and the gifts in the body, within the body of Christ, come in. And so we need to help our young people identify those gifts and to use those gifts to serve God. Encourage them to be camp counselors, to do other things in the summer months of those latter teenage years, especially where they can perform those operations. It's a very good time for serving other people. And that is how we can teach that identity. Let's look very briefly for a moment at developing love for others across the life cycle as well. In the foundational years, the preschool years, I think love for others comes out of, and I'm putting this maybe on a little bit of shaky ground, but I don't feel too shaky or I wouldn't do it, taking the three Greek words, eros, phileo, and agape, and looking at it from that standpoint. I think to a real large extent in the preschool years, there's concern for others because to some degree it's good for me. And so we want our children to have a healthy self-concept during this time. They learn to share with others. There's more altruism maybe than we are giving them credit for in this stage. But that's apparently part of what you go through in life to learn concern for others. During the middle childhood years, Kohlberg says morality, it's a morality that is concerned with what's fair, with what benefits the most people. What's right and wrong is what is beneficial. And so I think there's a real, I like you because you like me in that case. We need to teach them to learn to love peers, to observe, learn to observe from others' perspective, that decentration, to be able to see it from someone else's point of view. And then the need for respected adult role models during this time as well. Then during the adolescent years, I believe with the idealism that comes up, we can work toward the idea that love for others is love or concern for them in spite of what the other person is like. I love you because God created you, is the idea. This comes with verbal teaching, appealing to the ideals that they would be upholding. Look at the prophets and social justice, books of the passages of the Bible that deal with that. And once again, watching our parental lifestyle ourselves. Let's end just with a few summary points and notations. First of all, I think that you probably are reacting in one of two or three different ways. One of those may be, this is very demanding. What I am talking about is very demanding of parents. And I would say that's true. I can't get around that. I wish that it were very easy and everything came easily, but that's not the case. It demands our time. It demands that we have personal discipline. Our own lifestyle, I keep bringing that up time and time again, is we must love God if we want to teach our children to love God. We need to have a certain degree of knowledge of the Bible if we're going to talk to our children about the Bible. We need to learn to discipline ourselves to look for teachable moments in a child's existence. And to talk to them about, let me give you one illustration of what I'm talking about. A few weeks ago, or a couple of months ago, we met Vicki's parents halfway between Nashville and Louisville. They live in Nashville. We live just outside of Louisville. We met them to pick up the kids. I think our boys had been down at their house. As we were eating supper, Vicki's mother got an item off the salad bar and gave it to Jacob. Jacob is six, and he was concerned because he had not ordered the salad bar. Well, there's a teachable moment right there. I didn't recognize it at first, but the next day I got to thinking about it, I thought, well, this is a good time because he was being honest, and it was a legitimate concern. I would agree with what he was saying there. And so we talked to him. I sat down and talked to him. I said, you know, it doesn't always, sometimes it costs you to be concerned with what's right and what's wrong. There's a price that has to be paid. But God takes care of you and shared some of that. Well, there are teachable moments that come up during life together in the home. And then we need to be students of our own children. There we have to discipline ourselves in that case as well. But nurturing love for God is not in the home is not just demanding. It's also rewarding. It's rewarding to see our children develop to their fullest potential for God. It's rewarding to know that as parents, our lives have meaning. I think one of the major things that we need to see in the church is that Christian parenthood is a ministry in and of itself. It's rewarding to know that we, as I said, are ministers of God in our own homes, when we are teaching our children or nurturing them to love God. What are the starting places? Well, first of all, it may sound like that I think all parents are perfect or should be perfect. There are no perfect parents. I've got a story of Black Friday. I wish we had time to give that. Vicki probably is glad we do not have time to give that, but we've had our black moments, to say the least, and you just have to realize you're not perfect. Go on, make the best of it. Usually there's a teachable moment in that. There was in that Black Friday. It ended up to be a pretty decent Saturday afterwards. We need to become intentional. When people say, well, this is too much, or I can't teach my children about God or nurture them, my answer is you are teaching your children about God. The question is, are you intentional or are you not intentional with it? We need to become intentional. We need to do our best. As I said earlier, start in one place and make progress there, then branch out into other areas. And then I believe there's a real need for parent education in churches. There's a need for better literature in this area. There's a need for parenting courses, I believe, that are spaced regularly over the family life cycle. that looks into more details at the areas that we have been talking about today very briefly. I've hit just the highlights. You can use workshops or special classes or special seminars, regular classes, to accomplish much of this. Eventually, I hope that we have enough parents that are working in this area that children begin to learn these principles in their homes as well. As we close today, I would like to encourage you to keep us in your prayers. I have a real concern for this as a vital part of my ministry. I hold seminars and other things, and I would like for you to remember Vicki and I in your prayers. Obviously, we're in the process of growing in our own family. We also need your prayers for doors to be opened and then for us to have the ability and the courage to go through those doors when they are open. I also want to thank you for your attention today. I know that especially this last hour, we've covered a lot of material. I've been spitting it out kind of like Jack Lewis. I don't know if you know Jack Lewis from Harding Graduate School or not. I was shocked, to say the least, the first night that I sat in a course under Dr. Lewis. We went for an hour and 45 minutes with no stop. Took probably 10 or 15 pages of notes. We had a 10-minute break, back for another hour and 45 minutes. I feel like you've hit that kind of feeling maybe today. I do want to thank you for your attention. Hope that God will bless and keep each one.